Hey, everyone listening to the podcast. This is Ari. We have some exclusive content for you that did not air in full on the show. And I've read some of your comments that you guys like it when we peel the curtain back and share extra stuff. So first of all, when I sat down with John Turturro, who plays a very great character of a defense lawyer in The Night Of, as well as, of course, you may remember from The Big Lebowski and a lot of other great movies, I sat down with him and Nick Ackerman. And this is a longer conversation we're about to play for you. Part of it played on TV on Fallback Friday, but a bunch of it didn't. John's clearly a very interesting guy, a classic humanist, and you can hear this longer conversation. That's the first thing. Then after that, we want to share with you my conversation with Isaac Mizrahi, talking about designing Michelle Obama's big dress for the State of the Union, and our own Craig Melvin, and it is a funny conversation. I thought they were a riot. I gave Isaac a little bit of a hard time for his claims that he's reading all of Shakespeare's works at once, and he's got a new book out. So we get into all that. Then after that, dessert for people like us who consider this dessert, my entire unedited exclusive interview with Senator Elizabeth Warren from late in the week on the very day that she unveiled a big new plan to take on corporations, big tech companies. We got into that. Paul Manafort, she said if he were black, he would have gotten a much harsher sentence. She took on Goldman Sachs. We got into a lot of stuff. So that is the third and final thing. Several of these, as I say, are unedited, so you're going to hear stuff that hasn't aired before. It's new to the podcast, new to you. Thanks, as always, for listening. Give us 5 stars or whatever you think we deserve. And thanks for listening to The Beat with Ari Melber. And I'm joined by Emmy Award-winning actor John Turturro, who's currently starring in the film Gloria Bell with Julianne Moore. Other notable films include, of course, Quiz Show, Michael Bay's Transformers franchise, and, of course, his collaborations with the Coen brothers, including the unforgettable role as Jesus Quintana in, yes, The Big Lebowski. Do you want to run that back so it's on time? Yeah. You want me to slow down? You just tell me. You want me to slow down in one of them? I could slow down in Transformers. No? Okay.
This is my life, usually.
All right, now look, we're going to do it.
This never happens on this.
John, we're going to do 15 more takes.
That's fine. So you're kind of like Robert De Niro, isn't it? Yeah.
It's time for a special edition of Fallback. I'm joined by Emmy Award-winning actor John Turturro, currently starring in the film Gloria Bell, along with Julianne Moore. Other notable films include Quiz Show, Michael Bay's Transformers franchise, and, of course, the collaborations with the Coen brothers, including the unforgettable role as Jesus Quintana in The Big Lebowski, one of our favorites. Turturro also played a scrappy lawyer in the HBO hit The Night Of, which is something he has in common with our other guest. Nick Ackerman also plays a lawyer on television and was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District and, of course, a Watergate special prosecutor. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Great to be here.
Nick, who needs to fall back?
Who needs to fall back is Roger Stone. I mean, his Instagram account is absolutely his problem here. He doesn't know when not to post photographs on Instagram. First, it's the judge with crosshairs. Then he's now put into, you know, this whole business about Roger Stone being innocent. It's just going to wind him up in jail. And I might add, I also have a little bit of a bone to pick with Roger Stone on that, too.
Pick it.
He's got me on his Instagram page, and he calls me a cranky old man. Now, first of all, I'm not cranky. You know that. And old, well, yeah, but Roger Stone isn't that much, you know, younger than me. And I'm also not senile, which he also claims. And I think the viewers know I'm not senile. So as far as I'm concerned, Roger Stone can go to jail just for that.
John, I feel what we're learning here is, wow, is one, according to this legal opinion,
Roger Stone is the defense attorney.
Go for it. I mean, we're learning that Nick...
I don't know if I would take him on as a client. I probably wouldn't get paid.
Yeah, he wouldn't pay you.
Yeah, I wouldn't get paid. So.
Well, Nick's saying Roger's being stupid. He's also clearly using Instagram to go at you, so you're getting his attention.
And to you, too, I might
I've add. Seen some yes. of that. Do you get the feeling that Roger may have wanted to be an actor in another life?
Well, a lot of these guys are actors. They're more of an actor than I am, actually.
Really? You
know? Yeah, I think there are many people in the political arena. I could never do what they do because I try to really believe what I'm doing and research what I'm doing. So I understand something about the topic that I'm portraying.
Yeah.
And I'm
you
sort of
not make it in politics.
Yeah, no, I'm really flabbergasted by politicians and people in the political arena, how they can just talk about things that they know so little about.
Yeah, and that some of them seem to be obviously very motivated in Roger Stone's case by making a spectacle. He's not helping himself, whether he realizes it or not. John, who do you think, what do you think needs to fall back?
I think the oversimplification of any news topic is something that really sort of bothers me. Just the oversimplification, how they make everything into black and white, devoid of an historical context when they're talking about certain issues, whether it's politics, racism, Me Too movement. The gray area, or the gray zone, as a great writer, Primo Levi, wrote about in his book, The Drowned and the Saved. I think that's really where most of humanity lives, in the gray area. And so the loss of nuance, I think, is a major problem. And that's why these things like Instagram and, when you're tweeting and everything, it's devoid of nuance.
Do you think it's something that is accelerated by the internet, or is it in our nature as human beings to oversimplify?
I think it's been accelerated, absolutely.
We heard you might do this, and I have some examples to throw up here for you.
Oh, really?
To see, yeah, because we heard you were, this was on your mind.
Oh, God.
Here's one, a headline that said, scientists reveal three keys to happiness.
Right.
Oversimplified or not?
Oversimplified.
Another one we found, and this is from a cable news channel, not us, but another one that said, how climate change is fueling extremism.
Well, they could have...
There's a lot to be said about that, but I can't agree with you more. I mean, there's one thing I found in this whole experience of being on television is that the television news in particular focuses on the here and now and doesn't give you the context and the history. Okay. And we've got a president now who would flunk a sixth grade history test.
Mm. I was a substitute history teacher, so he would.
Substitute, though.
Yeah, but
Hold on, John. They never gave you the full-time
gig. No, they did, but I went back to grad school. So I went to Yale Drama School after that. So, but that's a perfect example that it's devoid of any historical context.
And what's the hardest part of being a substitute teacher?
Oh, controlling your class, making them respect you. I mean, I was a permanent substitute. I took over for someone.
So then you had the class.
So it was my class, yeah.
Because I went to a public high school in Seattle, and they would just grill the substitutes, test them.
This was a Catholic school. Christian Brothers of Ireland, Rice High School. And those guys were really tough. Then I taught at a fifth and sixth grade for the second part of the year. And that was harder to control because it was people around 10, 11 years old.
Yeah, I got one more on our list for you.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Uh-oh.
Are illegal immigrants, this headline says, the ones ruining America? Oversimplified?
Oversimplified.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, these are complex topics. And with complex solutions, but once you demonize a whole group of people, I mean, everyone was an immigrant, and they're talking about illegal immigrants, but that's a complex topic.
Mm-hmm. I got something that you guys have in common. You've done so many great performances. One of them that speaks to the Nick Ackermans of the world was your portrayal of a very hard scrabble defense attorney in The Night Of on HBO. Let's take a look.
The presumption of his innocence beyond a reasonable doubt. We hear that term a lot. What does it really mean, huh? What's its definition? It doesn't have one. It's what we think. And as much as what we think, what we feel.
Nick, how'd he do?
I thought he did pretty well. I mean, it was good. I mean, next trial I have, you're going to do my summation. I thought that was great. Now, I'm surprised the judge didn't intervene, because once you say there's no definition of beyond a reasonable doubt, the judge gives a very specific charge on that. So this is like kind of a typical television or movie type.
Oh, my God. John,
you have to take a liberty.
Hold on. Leave it to Nick Ackerman.
I disagree with him.
Leave it? Yeah, go ahead. Why?
No, he's right.
Leave it to Nick Ackerman to say. say there would be an objection.
Of course there would.
But what did you think of the feeling and the
thought? Yeah, well, you have to see it in context.
No, but he was looking at the jury. He was being honest. He was coming. He was basically connecting with people. And I think that's what makes a great summation and a great trial.
You felt so raw and real in that role. How did you get to that place?
I spent a lot of time with a lot of lawyers who were very helpful to me and did a lot of research. And there was one lawyer who works in Brooklyn who's actually a terrific lawyer, Kenny Montgomery. And he was very, very helpful to me because he was the lawyer that my character maybe could have been, but in delineating the cost of being a good lawyer and how you have to be able to separate that from your personal life. He really took me through all the steps, and it was really, really helpful.
What is so stressful about that kind of role when you were studying those people?
If you have someone's life in your hands, that's, I think, pretty stressful. You should answer that question.
You're doing a criminal case. I mean, you really have pressure. I mean, it's not like a civil case where you're worried about, it's just money. But right. When somebody's life is at stake and could actually go to prison for a long time, I mean, you feel like you've got the weight of the world on your back, and you do everything you can to present the best possible case you can for your client. And that's kind of the way you came across so earnestly is the way you would want a trial lawyer to come across in appealing to a jury to let them know that this is an important issue, it's significant, and that beyond a reasonable doubt really is important. I think that was done really well.
So, I mean, you know, every life is valuable. So I don't know how I would feel if I had someone's life in my hands, you know. So that was the idea. Yeah.
There's something very, gentle about you.
Me? Well, I think gentleness is underrated. I think Abraham Lincoln said there's nothing stronger than gentleness. And I think that's something in our society that there's a great lack of. And because usually the wisest people, it comes from a quiet place, not from a loud place.
I would totally agree with that because Abraham Lincoln couldn't be elected president today because of the media, because of the way he looked, and his basic demeanor. He was an extremely thoughtful person. He was very focused on facts. He was very focused on doing the right thing and the right job in understanding his context and history. Right. And it's very difficult for somebody like that in the age where you have to have sound bites, where you have to appeal in a certain way and you're using polls and you're basing your opinion on opinion polls as opposed to what you think is the right thing. I think the Abraham Lincoln example was spot on.
It's really fascinating as people who can hold your attention and take space and dominate the scene will be elected, but they may be the worst leaders. And it's, history has proved that many times over, may I add. But, I guess if it wasn't for my business, probably, and a writer's strike in the 90s, maybe reality television would have never happened. And because of reality television, someone was able to hone a persona and to bring them all the way up into, the most powerful position in the country. Mm. And that is an essential thing because you learn basic craft elements of how to keep someone's attention. And people were convinced that this was the character, and it's actually a fabrication of who the person actually was. And so we've seen this over and over, again.
I think it's a great reminder and a toast to gentility.
Okay.
John Turturro, Nick Ackerman, thanks to both of you.
All right.
We're joined by award-winning designer Isaac Mizrahi, whose trend-setting fashions are worn by stars from Nicole Kidman to Julia Roberts to First Lady Michelle Obama, once donned a plum-colored Mizrahi dress to the State of the Union, the ultimate endorsement. Mizrahi, I should mention, also a judge on Project Runway All-Stars, and he has a new memoir out, I Am, recounting growing up as a gay man in a Syrian Jewish Orthodox household. And we're also joined by another Syrian Orthodox Jew, A man who is something of a fashion icon in our newsroom, where the standards are admittedly lower.
Wow.
Today's show host and NBC correspondent Craig Melvin, who also anchors the 11 hour on MSNBC and has interviewed everyone from Bill Clinton to Nikki Haley to Richard Overton, the oldest living veteran in America.
Who we recently lost, actually, but yeah.
Oh, wow. Those were nice introductions, all right.
I was just thinking about the work you've both done.
Did you interview Michelle Obama, though?
No, not on camera. No, that's right.
You know what?
You won before that.
Yeah, I did.
Well, a lot of people would say you won, because having a first lady, any first lady, go to the State of the Union in your dress. Before we do our fallbacks, what was that feeling like?
It was crazy. I was at dinner during that time. I had this very important dinner that had been pre-scheduled, and someone called in the middle, and I just literally left the restaurant without telling people, and I went home to watch.
So they didn't tell you, the White House, in advance, hey, she's wearing, am I saying it right? She's wearing Mizrahi tonight.
They never let you know. She did it a few times. She wore my clothes a few times, and every time it was a big surprise.
Craig, what are you wearing?
Right now? This is a brown suit with some subtle blue stripes that I've probably had for 7 years. Isaac, I apologize. But I got to be honest with you. If I had known that I was going to be sitting right here, I would have put on something nicer.
Something like Prada or something, right? Yeah.
Yes. Like, is that who you recommend for men? Who do you wear?
This is from a guy called David August in Los Angeles.
You don't wear your own stuff?
No, I don't.
So you're right here, you're not wearing any. The only Mizrahi here is what's inside the suit.
Actually, the shirt is Mizrahi.
That's Mizrahi.
And the pants are Mizrahi, but the jacket, you know, tailoring is like.
Can I touch it?
What, the shirt?
No, just the jacket.
The jacket, you can touch anything you want. Please.
This is really nice.
It's pretty nice, right? He makes good stuff.
Do you wear sweatpants?
I do, yes.
Because, Lagerfeld, when he died, that was one of the famous quotes.
You know, what? Oh, yeah, you give up if you're wearing sweatpants.
Right. You want to just come sit over here?
I know. Every time I'm sorry. It's hard for me not to ask questions.
You're both really pretty, okay?
Thank you.
You see?
Thank you for saying that. It's not that it's a competition. It's just he has what's called anchoritis.
Yeah.
And it's very useful if you don't even know what you're doing. You walk around, you sit down at a dinner party or a TV set, and you just start interviewing.
Questions.
And he's very good at it. That's why he's a Today Show host.
I'm sorry.
It's just something that happens.
I apologize.
You almost wonder if it's leading to an awkward silence.
I'm amazed that millions of people watch this show.
That's a feature.
I am flat out amazed.
I'm amazed that thousands of people watch the show.
Do you know he beats? He beats CNN every night.
I couldn't resist.
He beats CNN. People watch them.
Thank you. That happens to be a fact. We deal in facts. Thank
we do.
You
facts matter.
For spotlighting a positive fact.
Also, just a joke.
You guys are tremendous. This could be the show. You know, in Seinfeld, when he says,
it's true. This is the show. I feel like we have a chemistry.
We should do a show together.
What is this?
Fashion and politics.
Abbott and Costello.
Let's do it.
I love
it.
Having said that,
I think we should.
Having said that, Isaac Mizrahi, who needs to fall back?
Oh, here we go.
Okay, my first fallback is the manhole rat. You know the manhole rat?
I saw.
Tell us.
It was a rat that got trapped, I think it's in Germany, and the thing is, there are these pictures of him, and at first you go, I don't want to look at the pictures, but then you look at the pictures, and they're so cute. Like this little rat.
The fireman or the rat?
Because I had this whole turnaround about, I love dogs, I love animals. I kind of don't work with furs anymore. You know, I can barely eat a steak, seriously. So I had this whole thing about, animals. Yeah. And then I thought, no, but rats, I don't care. Rats are just dirty. They're awful.
Yeah.
And then I saw the pictures of the rat, and then I kind of loved the rat. And then I said to myself, no, stop the rat.
You felt
just
bad
stop
for the, rat?
The whole thing. I felt bad for the rat. It's a very cute series of pictures.
And wasn't it unfair of the president to call the witnesses he disagreed with rats? I mean, when rats, as you point out, can be such a delightful little creature.
That's right. Absolutely. I also love the fact that the rat got so fat that he, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's winter weight. Who didn't?
Well, I don't know about, you're in fashion. I don't know that he was fat. Maybe the rat was just getting to the body weight that felt for him.
That's his goal weight. Exactly. It was the rat's goal
weight.
Were you concerned about body shaming the rat? Is that what I just sensed there?
Exactly.
Look, if animals have feelings, when you prick them, do they not bleed?
Totally.
That's a Tevye reference.
Exactly. Thank you.
It's actually
a Merchant in Venice reference. It's a Shakespearean reference.
Well, Tevye remixed it, and I always quote hip hop, which is always remixing an earlier art form. Tevye remixing Shakespeare, but we'll take it. We'll take
it.
You're more knowledgeable.
Works.
You're more literary. I read your New York Times.
Oh, you did.
I read
the book.
I've never seen so much book bragging in a single
interview. No, but you know what? That was like a questionnaire that you fill out. So literally, it took me days. It was like
It took you days?
I was writing the gospel.
You know what it says in there? And I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm honored you're on the beat.
Scare me.
They say, what's on your nightstand? And he says, the complete works of Shakespeare. And I thought, are they?
Wait a minute.
Are all of them on your nightstand?
Excuse me, darling.
How large is your nightstand?
And by the way, I have a big nightstand.
Okay.
I'm sure you've heard a big nightstand, what that means.
It means you read a lot.
It
means you read a lot.
But they're not only, it's not just the big volume of it, it's the actual separate plays, because the big volume is unwieldy, and sometimes I like to pick up.
This is true, because we do, the fact that I like you, and I like you a lot, that's why I'm thrilled you're here.
I love you.
I love you. All right, you know what? I love you.
I love you unconditionally, like a mother loves their child.
Wow,
Like like a Jewish mother?
That's a Jewish mother, exactly.
Why the hell do you have lighters on your desk here? This is 1968. What are you going to
There's like, the light beat up lighters. Break we also have beat wine glasses from the MSNBC moms. I'm going to move to my fallback,
and
I'll give you a little spoiler.
Sure.
It involves a guest who's on the show right now.
Oh,
come on.
And it's fashion related, and it is. Let's see it. Craig Melvin's high school outfit.
That's, you know what?
Needs to fall back.
This is
Craig, we give you the floor, and then Isaac, you can evaluate.
Now, here's the thing. Isaac, okay. Now, wait, you just said you didn't judge people.
No, I'm not judging.
Those are eyes of judgment.
Here's the thing. What I wonder is, like, isn't a fallback supposed to be something that people are, like, actually talking about and into and whatever? And
Everyone's talking about this tonight.
Well, okay.
In 1994, everyone was talking about that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's like that thing in Mean Girls with like fetch, like stop trying to make fetch happen. I think you should stop making that photograph happen. You should stop trying to make that happen, and then we won't have to make it.
So that your view is that outfit from Craig's what senior year is not
that would not Fred. No, that was not for my senior year.
I don't know why. I don't know the plaid thing. You have to rethink that.
I was in middle
plaid.
School.
Yeah,
is
okay.
It?
It's all right.
But there's some things that you
was
probably
was it something you were forced to wear, like the plaid was
no,
the school
I remember,
plaid or something.
I remember this. I picked that out because I was.
You look like you were feeling.
If you
yourself.
Told me that I wasn't fly that night at the prom, you would have had to fight me.
Well, can I tell you something? This is not just flattery. Like, you are fine now, and you were not as fine in college, in high school. I swear to God.
And I think we'll leave it there. Thanks, you guys. Isaac Mizrahi and Craig Melvin. Joining me now is Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts and a 2020 presidential candidate. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You have criticized a lot of big banks. Today you're talking about breaking up big tech. Why?
Yep. So here's the deal. We need real competition in this field. And there's a problem. So Amazon, Google, they own a platform which is pretty cool, right? Where everybody comes to buy and sell or to do the searches. And at the same time, they own a bunch of businesses that are competing with all those folks who are coming, say, to Amazon in order to sell their goods. And they don't just compete straight up. They compete by being able to keep all of the information from every one of those companies and then decide, oh, I'm going after you and you, and I know how much to charge, and I know what kind of volume to expect. You know, it's a little, excuse me, it's a little like being an umpire in baseball and owning a team. My view is you can do one, be an umpire, or the other, own a team, but you don't get to do both at the same
time. Right, and you want to regulate so they don't just favor themselves. You dropped this plan today. This is your first big TV interview about it. Let's take a look at some of the reception today.
Okay. Senator Elizabeth Warren is going after big tech companies.
Warren rolling out one of her big policy planks, breaking up Amazon, Google, and other big tech giants.
This is the toughest plan that we've seen to date from any of the Democratic contenders.
For a huge shakeup in the tech sector.
It's big and it's bold and it's going to be difficult to achieve.
Could she really force this kind of breakup?
Could she really do it?
What's
the answer?
The answer is yes. But you know, let's be really clear about this. If you still want to be able to search for coffee pots and look at, you know, 63 choices and get the one that's going to be there in 48 hours, you can still do that as a consumer. This preserves the platform. If you still want to go on Google and find out the capital of North Dakota, you can totally do it. What this is about competition. It's about all those little businesses and startup businesses and entrepreneurs who want to put their products on Amazon or on Google. and who are at an enormous competitive disadvantage because Amazon or Google, if they like the money they see that you're making because they get all the information, they decide to go into competition with you and put their product on page one and your product back on page six and kill your business.
Let's go through some of these companies so we can all understand. Yes or no, and then we'll get into them.
Sure.
Do you view them as operating monopolies? Google.
So, Google, yeah. They're pretty much in a monopoly position.
Amazon.
Oh, yeah. They've got, can we just do on Amazon?
Well, I'm going to go
49%.
Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apple.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at Facebook first, and then we'll go through each of them.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Zuckerberg disagrees with you. Take a look.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Okay.
Is he wrong?
Yes. Because he has the Facebook platform. That's the key part here. So if you want to check on what your college roommates are up to, you got to go to his platform. And the part that gives him, and I really want to describe it this way, monopoly power, is that so many folks have got to come to his platform to be able to transact. He wants to be able to sell ads, for example, on that. The problem is, he's scooping all this information up.
Facebook is your arm in this analogy?
That's right.
This is the Facebook.
That's exactly right.
And then what goes on?
And then what happens is he uses all this information and then makes the decisions about how to scoop up others in the marketplace. For example, he runs a buy and sell for ads. So he's in every position on that, a buyer of ads, a seller of ads, and running the little platform where those are sold. That just creates an enormous competitive advantage. And here's the problem on every one of these. These advantages are now so enormous that venture capital is starting to say, wait a minute, if you're going to go into a space where you could in some way be challenging Amazon or be challenging Facebook or be challenging Google, it is now referred to as the kill zone. And venture capital has gone down, investment by about 20% over the past 5 years or so, because they're just saying it doesn't make any sense.
So if your plan is enacted, do each of those companies get somewhat broken up?
So what they get is the platform gets broken off from the individual companies. That's what I say.
And you're saying that's good for consumers.
It's excellent for consumers because it not only means the platform will be level. You're not getting something from Amazon pushed out in front of you and a better competitor hidden back on page six. It also means the next good idea has a chance to mature.
Right, that Amazon, just like everyone remembers with booksellers, is not going to be kneecapping everyone.
That's right.
You're here on the beat tonight announcing this plan today, and you're campaigning in Long Island City.
I am.
Where Amazon just pulled out. Is that deliberate?
That's right. You bet it's deliberate.
What are you saying?
What I'm talking about is how big these tech giants have gotten, so that what we see, and we saw right there on Long Island City, is they come in, they bully towns, cities, states all around the country. You know, the handful of tech giants have gotten more than $10 billion in breaks from towns and cities and states over the past few years.
Corporate welfare.
That's right.
Let me ask you this. Is that a problem with the incentives, or was New York wrong to give them that much of an
offer? The problem is the Hunger Games about it, because that's what's happening here. And it's a problem because it creates more concentration in the industry. You know, they're not offering the cities and towns a zillion bucks in goodies and tax breaks to the entrepreneur who's getting started, to the small business that's trying to make a go of it, even to the medium-sized business and big business that want to grow more. Nope. This is about the giants who are able to swagger into town and say, lay in front of me what you're going to offer, and I'll decide if I like it or not, and then I'll go somewhere else and see what they'll offer. And by the way, if you start asking me hard questions about the jobs, about where the money's going to come from, about how much guarantee I'm putting into this, I'll just get mad and go somewhere else.
So your new plan also talks a lot about antitrust. Mm-hmm. You've been critical of the AT&T merger with CNN's parent company.
Yes.
So has Donald Trump. But the New Yorker reported this week his reason was he wanted to use those powers to beat up on CNN.
That's right.
Is that wrong? And if so, what do you do about it?
Yes, it's very wrong. For the president to say, I want to see an antitrust prosecution based on political advantage to the president is about as wrong as it gets. What I want to see is antitrust enforcement because it protects markets, because it protects small competitors, because it protects consumers over the long run.
So how do you deal with what he has allegedly done, and should there be punishment for that?
Well, I think we need, I mean, I think there's going to be a very serious investigation about this. There's a fundamental question about whether what he's done is even legal.
Well, that may have been an illegal way to attack CNN.
May have been.
Interesting, which they happen to be a competitor, but we're interested in more as the free press issue. Let's go to the way the Treasury Department is run.
Uh-huh.
Because you look at it right now, and I'll draw your attention to a very simple illustration. Under Donald Trump, we could put up on the screen, you have in the red zone there, Goldman Sachs.
Yes.
As part of Treasury Department leadership. But if you go back during the Obama era, we checked, and as you know, we had Goldman Sachs former executives running Treasury then. You go back to Bush, also Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. You go back to Bill Clinton, also Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. In a Warren administration, would there be a former Goldman Sachs executive running the Treasury Department?
Nope.
Is that a pledge?
Yes. Oh, that's easy.
So that's a litmus test.
Absolutely. But let me tell you why. The problem we've got right now is a revolving door between Wall Street and Washington that causes everybody to be on guess for, wait a minute, the next time this Treasury Secretary puts forward a proposal, is it because it really helps the economy, helps the American consumer, helps the American homeowner, or is it because it helps their former and possibly future employer? Let's just do for 1 second the Gary Cohn example, another Goldman Sachs. You remember.
With Trump, sure.
That's exactly right. So Trump appoints Gary Cohn. He leaves Goldman Sachs. And Gary Cohn is going to have exactly one job, and that is to ramrod through a rewrite of the tax laws that will profoundly affect Goldman Sachs. So what does Goldman Sachs do as Gary walks out the door? They hand him nearly a quarter of $1 billion. It's a gift. They don't have to.
Is it legal bribery?
I think of it as a pre-bribe.
Pre-bribe.
Yes. So Gary then goes out, and guess what he does? He writes a tax law and manages to help ramrod it through that benefits Goldman Sachs to the tune of, oh, a quarter of $1 billion in the first go-round.
And what you're saying...
And then it's the gift that keeps on giving.
What you're saying makes sense, and we have such ripe targets. I think people could understand what you're pointing to. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean for the Democratic Party if this was... Also, how Obama and Clinton ran the Treasury. Would you be a fundamental break with that, I guess, is the question.
The problem, I have written the biggest anti-corruption bill since Watergate because we have a fundamental problem in Washington. And understand, it's a problem that predates Trump by decades.
Right.
Trump may be the most extreme example now, the pre-bribes of Gary Cohn, for example. But we have a long-standing problem, and that's the influence of money on decision-making in Washington. So this bill has lots of pieces to it, including closing the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, ending lobbying as we know it, putting a real ethics cop on the beat, saying that the heads of these agencies cannot be trading in stocks.
So as a political matter, are you basically writing off a bunch of Wall Street money, and then today you're writing off a bunch of Silicon Valley money?
Maybe. But this isn't about the money. This is about how it is we're going to make this country work again, not just for the rich and the powerful, how we're going to make it work for everyone. You know, we live in an America right now where Washington works great for giant drug companies, just not for people who are trying to fill a prescription.
You talk about how the Beltway works.
Yeah.
Everyone has been talking about the rather light sentence that Paul Manafort got. When you look at that, does that reflect what you're saying when Washington works well for the connected and the affluent and nobody else?
Yeah. It's two justice systems. Look at the words carved above the United States Supreme Court, equal justice under law. But look at the reality. People who got buckets of money and are well connected get treated with kid gloves.
So do you think
everybody else doesn't?
Do you think when you look at that statistically, that a similar defendant who might have been poor and black would have gotten a different sentence?
Oh, we know the data on this. Of course the sentence would have been different. In fact, study after study after study shows that for the exact same crimes, African Americans are more likely than whites to be arrested, to be prosecuted, to be wrongfully convicted, and to receive harsher sentences. Race matters in our criminal justice system, and it is not a system of equal justice under law.
On the Mueller probe, I read a pledge you recently made. You said, this is interesting, you would issue, quote, no pardons for anyone implicated in the investigations into Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. How can you know that before the investigations are over? Would that include someone like Andy McCabe, the former acting FBI director, who's under investigation right now in the D.C. office?
Because I know what pardons are for. Pardons are there for the powerless to show a little justice that they need. Pardons are not there as part of a plea agreement. That's somewhere else in the system. We reserve pardons for those people who didn't receive justice under the law. And I'm not there to say pardons are going to be part of a political horse trade of my administration. Uh-uh.
Does that mean you would commit to saying you're never going to pardon anyone that worked directly for you?
I assume so. I mean, I don't know of any case why I would do that. This is about the powerless. That's what pardons are supposed to be about. Not about people who have connections, not about people who have a way to be protected, who can hire the lawyers, who get to work their way through the system, who get the best representation. Pardons are about one last way that we try to put a little justice back into a system that today is very unjust.
If Bob Mueller finishes this probe with no further indictments, so they don't indict anyone in America for helping the Russians collude, what do you think then is the conclusion? And do people who were hoping this would all bust Donald Trump have to accept those lawful findings, even if they don't go as far as some want?
I don't know what his report's going to say, and we just have to wait and see. But I'll tell you this about his report, that it has already produced nearly three dozen indictments or guilty pleas. Hmm. This is a serious investigation. In addition to that, we've got investigations that are going on in other jurisdictions, and the House has just started its own series of investigations. You know, the sound of hoofbeats of all those investigations catching up with Donald Trump must be loud in his ears.
Hmm. I want to ask you about some politics and some of the fun stuff. What makes you tick?
Okay.
On the politics, the Democratic Party's announced you guys aren't going to do any debates with Fox News. Is that the right call?
You know, this is ultimately a decision for the party to make. But I do understand that when more and more keeps coming out about how Fox News was just operating as an arm of the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration, boy, that doesn't much look like we really have a free and independent press. It just looks like a propaganda machine.
So you agree with the
chairman? I understand why it is that the Democratic Party would say, we're just not going to be a part of that. And I want to be able to get out and talk to everyone. I mean, I'll just tell you that as a candidate. Mm-hmm. I want to be in everybody's living room. I want a chance to reach out to everyone.
And that makes sense. I guess the thing we heard from a lot of activists was, while you might go talk to whoever you choose to, why should, as you put it, an entity that was perceived as being an arm of the Trump administration help pick who runs against Trump?
And I think that's part of why the Democratic Party as a party says we got a real problem here.
Mike Bloomberg, do you want his endorsement?
Look, I'm glad to have everybody's endorsement, but I'm not out looking for any of them.
You're not going to ask?
Not asking.
You're not asking, Mr. Nope. Bloomberg.
Not asking.
Okay. Bernie Sanders has more individual donors right now than any other Dem candidate by a long ways. Is that because he's really popular with the grassroots, or is it because he's good at raising money?
I assume it's because he's popular with the grassroots. Bernie's been out there fighting his fight. And, you know, that's got a lot of people energized.
Is he the front runner?
You need a pundit for this, but it sure looks like it. I mean,
it does look like it.
Punditry is not my
not
business,
your thing.
But
let me ask you something. I was wondering, because you spent most of your life in other types of service. How old were you when you first thought, I think I might run for office?
Oh, golly. Well, let's see. I could just do the math, but I was in my 60s. I never was going to do this.
When you were teaching, this was not the next step.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Which separates you from people. Now, there's anything wrong with wanting it, but as you know, a lot of people who make it to the White House, they've been thinking about it their whole life.
What I've been thinking about my whole life is what's happening to working families in America. This has been the central question of the last 30 years for me. Why is it that America's middle class has been hollowed out? Why is it that people who work hard find that the path today is rockier and steeper than ever before? And why is it that for people of color, the path has gotten even rockier and even steeper? That's the question that ultimately pulled me into the politics of running for office, and it's what I work on every single day. This is my life's work.
I'm going to run through a couple of the quick ones. They're fun, or at least maybe nerdy fun.
Okay.
And we can do them as fast as possible. We call it a lightning round sometimes.
Okay.
Past or present, favorite member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors?
Oh, Janet Yellen.
Janet Yellen.
Oh, she is fabulous. I'll tell you why.
Tell us why.
Go back and look at Janet Yellen's speech when she was sworn in. And you know what she talks about? Families. She talks about how Fed policy directly affects American families and how she has to think about that as she sets Fed policy. And here's the part that maybe is a little sad. I think she's the first and so far last Fed chair to do that.
Mm.
She's terrific.
International Women's Day, a woman, past or present, who inspires you?
Oh, let me think. Bella Abzug. You know, a woman who just got out there and fought for what she believed in. I love it.
I've got a couple one-word associations, if you could do it in a word. Okay. Some of them relate to your bill.
Okay.
Amazon.
Can I have two words?
Sure.
Too big.
Google.
Too big.
Facebook.
Too big.
Mark Zuckerberg.
Too powerful.
Hmm.
And that's really the point of the too bigs. It's they've got too much power. And they get to use that power now to dominate markets, to chew up competitors, and ultimately to change the consumer experience. We got to change that.
Favorite song to work out to?
Anything from Patsy Cline.
Patsy Cline.
Mm-hmm. Favorite, I love Patsy Cline.
Favorite album or artist when you were growing up?
Any of the Beatles.
Beatles, yeah,
probably,
sure.
Probably the White Album.
Yeah. Now I got to know your favorite Beatle.
Oh, no, that's not fair. That's like asking your favorite child. Right?
I would guess, what do I know? I don't know you that well. I would guess Lennon. George Harrison. Boom.
Yeah.
Your dream running mate throughout history, living or dead, if you could pick a person that would run with you.
Teddy Roosevelt.
A Republican.
Yeah.
Because he took on the trusts?
Because he was brave. And he took on the trusts. And he didn't care how many people were going to be mad about it. And he did it. This is what's amazing, for the right reasons. It wasn't just that they were big. It wasn't just that they were dominating an economy. It wasn't just that they were putting farmers out of business and competitors out of business and small companies out of business. It was that they had too much political power.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the very fact of that political power that caused Teddy Roosevelt to say, I'm going to be a trust buster. Man, I'd like to have that guy at my side.
There is a beloved actress who's been talking about you. Annette Bening.
Yes.
Let's take a look. I think we have this for you. Annette Bening says she knows she looks like Elizabeth Warren. Thank you very much. Now, look like you or do you look like her?
Either way, I'm totally happy with this comparison.
You like this?
Yes, I do.
You be comfortable if and when there's a Warren administration? And then there's a Warren movie. Would you be comfortable with her playing you?
I'm all in.
You're ready for that?
Mm-hmm, I'm ready.
Have you guys ever met?
Yes, actually.
And?
Once. I think she actually does. We kind of look like each
other. Did you talk about it at the time?
Yeah.
How could you not?
Yeah, how could we not?
We have to ask before we let you go how Bailey's doing. This dog is beloved on your campaign.
Dog is the best. Between the Bailey cam and the opportunity to meet people and voters, and people have been bringing him little treats. So Bailey's filling out now for a 10-month-old dog.
And he has his own greeting line as well as you.
Oh, man. He does a photo line like you wouldn't believe. And I want to be really clear about this, Ari. It is not a competition.
No.
I say this because I definitely do not want to be in competition with a 10-month-old golden retriever.
I've seen him. I'm a dog person myself. I'm sure he could get a lot of individual donors as well if he goes in that direction.
That's right.
Senator Warren, coming here on the day of your big tech announcement, we really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back on the beat.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.